Reggie, I just sold my car online.
Let's go, Grandpa. Wait, you did?
Yep, on Carvana. Just put in the license plate, answered a few questions, got an offer in minutes. Easier than setting up that new digital picture frame.
You don't say.
Yeah, they're even picking it up tomorrow. Talk about fast.
Wow, way to go. So, about that picture frame.
Forget about it. Until Carvana makes one, I'm not interested.
Car selling made easy. On Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
On May 30th, 2012, a 19-year-old single mother from Mobile, Alabama, went to visit her uncle and then vanished without a trace. What no one could predict was that Brittany Woods' disappearance would soon crack open one of the most shocking family secrets in Alabama's history. As investigators searched for Brittany, a multi-generational child sex abuse ring within her own family was brought to light. Now, more than a decade later, Brittany Woods' fate remains unknown, even as many of her relatives have been convicted of horrific crimes against children. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Brittany Wood. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. So this is a tough one, as you could probably guess from the intro.
Yeah, it sounds awful.
It is. So that's why I wanted to say up front that this does involve child sexual abuse. Unfortunately, there's just no way to talk about Brittany's disappearance without also talking about the abuse that was happening within the family. But while it is necessary context, the details are not necessary, so we won't be getting into it. We'll talk about the ages and some of the charges, but not specifics about courtroom testimony because it's awful and, like I said, it's just not necessary to the story. So I just wanted to make that clear at the top, just so listeners can make their best decision for themselves as to whether or not they want to continue. What's interesting about the allegations is that they came out publicly after Brittany's disappearance, though the investigation began prior.
The investigation for the sex assault?
Yep.
Wow.
So it is important to talk about in terms of how much what was happening within her family factored into Brittany's disappearance. And, you know, who knew what when and who was involved, who wasn't involved in the sex abuse ring, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, that we need to know the context of that to narrow down the suspects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's definitely confusing. Now, because this is such a complex story dealing with so many different people, it's also going to be a two-parter. Now, it's been a while since we've done one of these. I actually don't think we had any two-part episodes last season.
No, but we did have some
really long
episodes.
Yeah, we had a couple like 2.5 hour ones, but those were, you know, different from our normal format as well. But yeah, this is going to be a two-parter because I just couldn't fit it in to one episode and I didn't want this one to be 2.5 hours long. So part two will be released next week on Friday, but if you're a member of our Patreon, it will be available now. So speaking of which, we have a new member over on Patreon, so we want to take a moment to thank Summer A. Thank you, Summer, so much for your support.
Thank you.
As a reminder, if you'd like to get these episodes without all the ads and get part two of this early, you can join them at any level, starting at just $2 a month. You'll also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. So with all of that finished, let's get into part one of the story of Brittany Wood. Brittany Nicole Wood was born on September 25th, 1992 to Chessie Wood and Wallace Hankey. She was the middle child and had one older brother and one younger brother. At some point during her childhood, her parents split and remarried. Her father, Wallace, married Stephanie Hankey. Her mother remarried as well and ended up giving birth to two more children when Brittany was a teenager.
So five kids total.
Yeah, her mom has five kids. Brittany lived with her family in the Tillman's Corner area of Mobile, Alabama. Her childhood was not easy. When she was 9 years old, the man she grew up with as her de facto grandfather, her grandmother's longtime boyfriend, began to rape her. Brittany didn't tell anyone about the abuse until she was 12, at which point the man, Ronald Robertson, was arrested and put on trial. He was found guilty and sentenced to 25 years to life.
Jesus Christ.
And I want to add here, because I believe it's information that could potentially explain some parts of this story, that Robertson was with Brittany's maternal grandmother, Chessie's mother. The couple had been together so long that, according to the family, not only did he help raise Brittany, but he helped raise Chessie as well.
Okay. So probably some sexual abuse there, too.
And nobody has ever publicly come out and said that Robertson was sexually abusing anybody else in the family. Chessie has never said she was sexually abused, so I don't want to put those words in her mouth. I'm just saying it is a possibility, and it's something to maybe keep in the back of your mind as we're going through the story. Of course, Brittany was traumatized by the abuse, and things began to go downhill for her. She dropped out of school at 14, started using drugs, and by 16, she was pregnant. Her daughter Peyton was born when she was 17. According to Brittany's mother, Chessie, Peyton's father, Andy Hamilton, was abusive toward Brittany. There's a documentary about this case, a three-part documentary made for Peacock that aired in 2021 and has subsequently been scrubbed from the internet. I was talking to you about this earlier this week because I was trying to track it down and I couldn't find it streaming anywhere, like to buy or anything. But luckily, I did have somebody who was able to find a copy somewhere and deliver it to me on a thumb drive. So I was able to watch it. And it's really eye-opening. And it's really a shame that it's not airing anywhere right now, because I think it gives a lot of really good insight into the family.
Do you think it's been scrubbed because of lawsuits or because of pending trials or what?
No, it was filmed in 2019. Around 2019. It was released in 2021. And by then, the trials were basically over.
Okay.
So it wasn't anything like that. What I did read somewhere that, like, it was sold to maybe a different production company. And then that's kind of when it got taken off the streaming services.
Hmm.
So it could be it's just they have different distribution plans, you know?
Yeah.
And so it might pop back up at some point. It is interesting because Chessie is interviewed extensively for it, as well as several other family members. So, like I said, it really gives a good insight into who these people are, what was going on, and how the investigation unfolded.
Well, now I want to watch it.
Yeah. So anyway, in the documentary, the reason why I brought it up right there is because in it, there's audio of what sounds like a phone call between Brittany and Adam in which she accuses him of abusing her. You know, it's a whole conversation and she's just like, you know, like, what gives you the right to like hit me all the time? And he's like, I don't hit you. What are you talking about? She's like, you've hit every girlfriend you have. And she's like, you hit, you know, she named somebody. He's like, well, we weren't even dating at the time.
As though that makes it better.
Yeah. And like, you know, she punched me first. And so I hit her back. And then she's like, well, I didn't hit you when you beat the hell out of me in your truck. And, you know, like stuff like that. And he's like, yeah, well, so it seems as though the abuse claims are fairly valid. Everyone who knew Brittany said that she loved kids and loved her daughter. But in 2012, when Peyton was about two, neither of her parents seemingly had custody of her. Instead, she was being primarily raised by Andy's parents.
Okay.
From what it sounds like, and this is just kind of what I was able to gather from news articles, Peyton would be with them during the week and then go to Brittany's father and stepmother's house on the weekends.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then, you know, Brittany was mostly staying with Chessie, but, you know, I think would go over to her dad's house, too. And so, like, Andy and Brittany were both very much involved in Peyton's life. They just weren't in the position to provide a home for her, from what it sounds like.
Okay.
Now, Brittany had a lot of family in the Mobile area and would often bounce around between houses. But like I said, she primarily stayed with her mom, Chessie. According to Chessie, Brittany had a lot of, quote, psycho ex-boyfriends, end quote, and had begun carrying around a 25 caliber handgun for protection. So this was already all happening when a dark family secret began to emerge. In February 2012, police began investigating allegations of child sexual abuse implicating several of her relatives. This investigation began after one of her uncles, Chessie's brother, Randall Scott Wood, reported her other uncle, Donnie Holland, for sexual abuse of his own daughter.
Okay, so Chessie's brother.
Yeah, so it's Chessie's brother and Chessie's brother-in-law.
Oh, okay.
So I'll talk about that in a second. There are a couple last names that you're going to hear a lot that are going to be important. Wood is Chessie's family. So that's Brittany's maternal side. Holland, as in Donnie Holland, who we were just talking about, he married into the Wood family by marrying Chessie's sister, Wendy.
Got it.
The third last name you'll be hearing a lot is Kent, which is the family of Wendy's twin sister, Mendy.
Chessie and Wendy are sisters.
Yes.
And Wendy has a twin sister named Mendy?
Yes.
And why do they have different last names?
Because they're married. They both got married to different people.
All right.
So Chessie is one of five children. She has three sisters and a brother. So she has her sisters, Wendy and Mendy, who are twins.
Mm-hmm.
She has another sister, Sonia, who doesn't really factor into this a whole lot.
Okay.
And then her brother, Scott.
Got it.
Okay. Now, Wendy is married to Donnie Holland.
Who was accused of sexually abusing
their daughter.
His own daughter.
His own daughter.
Yes.
Mendy is married to Dustin Kent.
Got it.
Okay. This is why this had to be two parts. Like, it's too much already. Okay. So Scott Wood, Chessie's brother, told police that he had found extremely inappropriate messages between Donnie Holland and his 12-year-old daughter. The investigation officially began on or around March 5th, but was mostly in secret as police worked to gather evidence. But as it went on, police, of course, started contacting family members. So, you know, word of the investigation got out. But according to Chessie, she had no idea any of this was happening.
She had no idea the investigation was happening?
Yeah. She had no idea there was any sexual abuse going on within her family until...
I mean, except for what happened to her daughter.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Here's the thing. She says different things about how she found out. There are news articles. There's one particular Associated Press article in which she says she did not know about the investigation until after Brittany went missing. Her brother reported her brother-in-law at the end of February. The investigation officially started like a week later.
Mm-hmm.
Brittany didn't go missing until like 2 months after that.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way that she didn't know. I mean,
yeah,
if the police are already investigating and asking questions of other family members, the other family members are gonna talk about it, but keep it secret from Chessie.
Well, and yeah, exactly. And she says in the documentary that she found out about all of this from Scott, her brother, the one who reported Donnie, which makes total sense,
yeah.
Right? So she tells this story, but doesn't say when it happened. But according to her, she's like, oh, yeah, Scott found all this out because he had been staying with Donnie and Wendy because he didn't live in the area, but he had actually taken a job nearby. And so he was staying with Donnie and Wendy while he kind of got things figured out, you know?
Yeah.
So then when he found all this out and reported Donnie, he was like, well, obviously I'm not going to stay here. Like, right. That's insane, right?
Yeah.
So he called up Chessie and was like, hey, can I crash at your house for a few days while I figure things out? So she's like, yeah, Scott came over. We stayed up for 3 days talking about everything that was going on. But she's trying to say that she didn't find out until...
several months later?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, okay. The timelines aren't adding up.
But why? Why is she trying to conceal when she found out about this?
I don't know. And honestly, there are so many questions because there are so many conflicting stories that Chessie has told about different aspects of this over the years. And there isn't a single one of them that I can be like, oh, well, that's why she lied about that. Like, none of it. I don't understand any of it.
Mm.
So I don't know.
Okay. Worth keeping in the back of the head, though.
Exactly. So what we do know, timeline-wise, is that on May 27th, 3 days before Brittany was last seen, she received what she probably viewed as solid evidence. One of her cousins messaged her on Facebook and told her that she had been raped by several family members. She named three family members: Dustin Kent, Donnie Holland, and Scott Wood.
So all of them.
Scott Wood, the man who tipped off police about Donnie, was also accused of sexual abuse by a female relative.
Okay.
Maybe the same one.
Wow. Okay.
So rightly, the documentary and every news report, they're not naming any of these victims. And they're, you know, not even really specific on like how many children everybody has and what the genders are of the children that everybody has. Sure. You know what I mean? It does seem as though Donnie and Wendy had at least two daughters. And so I think that the one Scott was talking about was one daughter. And I think this was a different daughter. But again, I'm not sure. So Brittany and her cousin wrote back and forth about this. And it's been reported that the last message that Brittany sent to her cousin that night said, quote, I love you. I'm sorry. End quote. Eric Winberg, the Baldwin County Sheriff's detective who was assigned to the case, began working on it on March 5th. He's told reporters how important Brittany was to their investigation, saying, quote, we oftentimes look for that golden nugget, that one person that can make the difference in your case. In this particular case, Brittany Wood was that person. She was the person that could tell the whole story, end quote.
So there was motive.
Yeah. He also told reporters that he had texts from Brittany saying that she was willing to talk about what was going on in her family. Now, Brittany was staying with Chessie most of the time, like I said before. So I have a really hard time believing that Brittany wouldn't have brought this up at all. And again, I have a hard time believing that Chessie found all of this out after Brittany's disappearance.
Right.
When her brother was the one who blew the whistle and her daughter was speaking to police about it.
Yeah, I just, at this point, I just don't understand why.
Right.
Maybe something will come to light as this progresses, but like,
all I can really think of is just saving face. Like, you know, I didn't know about any of this. It's all a surprise. I thought my family was good. Like, you know, kind of a self-protection to kind of take maybe some guilt off of her.
Yeah.
Some culpability, some feelings of guilt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's kind of all I can think of, really. I mean, that's the only charitable answer I can think of, right. I should say.
Yeah.
At some point, if we do believe that this conversation she had with Scott about what he had seen over at Donnie and Wendy's house did in fact happen shortly after he went to the police, which is really the only way that it makes sense, Chessie didn't do anything with that information. Because she said in multiple interviews that, like, she had known Donnie her entire life. She'd been really close with him. He was a great guy. She let her children go over and, you know, stay at their house all the time. Like, she said this in interviews after Brittany disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So she knows this, but never thought to, like, talk to her children and say, hey, your uncle has been accused of this horrible thing. Like,
did he ever touch you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Now, to be clear, I keep harping on Chessie not because I think she was involved in Brittany's disappearance, because I don't. But I do believe that she's been dishonest about a lot of things over the years. So let's talk about May 30th, 2012, the night that Brittany disappeared. I'm so excited to come to you today and talk about our sponsor, Avocado Green Mattress. Their certified organic mattresses, pillows, and solid wood furniture are made without harmful chemicals and with thoughtfully chosen materials that are designed to support healthier living and more restorative sleep, which I know we all need. Because better sleep will change your mornings and it can improve the quality of your entire day. And that's why having a great mattress like an Avocado Green Mattress is so important. They're designed to support deep, restorative sleep so your body can properly recover, reset, and wake up ready to take on the day. And this isn't a short-term fix. Avocado mattresses are built to last with durable, high-quality materials. Avocado, dream of better. And now they're having a great sale on mattresses. Go to avocadogreenmattress.com/ATTWG to get up to 15% off. That's avocadogreenmattress.com/ATTWG for up to 15% off mattresses. avocadogreenmattress.com/ATTWG. Chronological age is your birthday. Biological age is how old your body really is, and it's the strongest indicator of disease risk and mortality. The True Age and True Health Combo Kit measures biological age versus chronological age and your current pace of aging. I've been using True Diagnostic for a while, and it's been so interesting to me to get the data that normal blood work just doesn't cover. My true age is pretty close to my chronological age, but there's always room for improvement. True Age tracks the health of 11 organ systems, including your heart, brain, and lungs. True Health checks over 105 vitamins, minerals, nutrients, and other health markers. But best of all, if you get the combo kit, it gives you 3 aging actions and 3 health actions to work on each quarter. So it gives you goals that you can actually achieve to improve your health. You order online, the kit ships right to your door. It's a quick, simple finger prick at home, and then you just drop it in the prepaid return package. You just follow the recommendations for the 90 days, and then you retest to see your progress. It uses advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over 1 million biomarkers. It's trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. And right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code ATTWG20 at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use code ATTWG20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or a subscription. Starting the year with a wardrobe refresh, Quince has you covered with luxe essentials that feel effortless and look polished. They're perfect for layering, mixing, and building a wardrobe that lasts. Their versatile styles make it easy to reach for them day after day. From soft Mongolian cashmere sweaters that feel like designer pieces without the markup, to 100% silk tops and skirts for easy dressing up, to perfectly cut denim for everyday wear, their wardrobe essentials are crafted to last season after season. Ethan and I both got cashmere sweaters, and we are loving them. He got this really nice quarter zip. I got a cute little short-sleeved one. I also got a pair of jeans that I'm absolutely obsessed with. I wear them all the time, and I want to get them in every color. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/ATTWG for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/ATTWG to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ATTWG. Chessie would later tell reporters that on May 30th, 2012, Brittany appeared to be in good spirits. She told her that she planned to visit her friend Courtney that night and everything appeared normal. In fact, in one article I read, she said something to the effect of, like, she couldn't have been happier. However, when she was interviewed later for Monster in the Shadows, the documentary, Chessie said that Brittany actually wasn't happy. In fact, she seemed a bit agitated or frustrated as she was leaving. When Chessie asked Brittany what was wrong, she replied that she wouldn't understand.
Why the two conflicting stories?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, let's keep going.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. There are so many things that Chessie has said over the years that directly contradict other statements that she's made. What we would later find out through cell phone records and interviews is that Brittany was never planning on going over to Courtney's that night. She was going to see her uncle, Donnie Holland, the main relative who was being investigated.
Okay, why?
Well, we don't know why, because she apparently just told people she was going over to Courtney's.
Yeah, why the secrecy? Why?
Exactly, why the secrecy? Why not just tell her mom?
Yeah.
Now, at the time, Donnie was staying at a house near the Styx River, which was about 40 miles from Chessie's house on the other side of Mobile Bay in Baldwin County. Now, I believe that that home was owned by Jennifer Moore, a family friend who we're going to talk about later. And I don't know why he was staying at that house, though. And I don't know if just he was staying there or if Wendy was staying there or what was happening.
Mm.
But at the end of May, he was staying at this house. Brittany called Donnie twice the evening of May 30th at 7:14 and 7:19. He came and picked her up at 7:30. No one actually saw Donnie pick Brittany up, but it was later confirmed by cell phone records. So they got her cell phone records and his cell phone records and saw that they were at the same place, you know?
Yeah.
Because of those cell phone records, we know that Brittany and Donnie went back across the bay to the Styx River area. She sent texts to her friend Jared at 9:25 and 9:27 p.m. Then, between 9:35 and 10:40, she exchanged multiple texts with her friend Bradley. She then exchanged multiple texts to a number that came across as unknown between 10:42 and 10:46 p.m. But then all communication from Brittany's phone suddenly stopped at around 11:30 p.m. on May 30th. Calls to her cell after that went straight to voicemail. Peyton's father, Andy, had spoken to Brittany a couple of times earlier in the day, but when he tried to call her after 11:30, he couldn't get through. In fact, there were several unanswered calls from Andy after 11:30, but as far as I can tell, he's never given an interview about this case, so we don't know what they had been talking about that night. Though the call stopped, Brittany's voicemail was accessed from her phone at 12:07 a.m.
Interesting. Okay.
Then, at 1:47 a.m., Brittany's phone pinged for the last time in an area called Grand Bay, specifically near a TA travel station. Now, that area is back across the bay, closer to Mobile and near her mom's house, you know, like on that side of the bay.
Right.
Okay. The phone pinged because a text was sent to Bradley from her phone. Now, we don't know what police learned from Bradley about his conversations with Brittany that night, but he has also never spoken publicly about the case. By the time filmmakers were making the documentary around 2019, he was dead.
Bradley was?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I don't know. I don't know how that happened. Because I don't have his last name, so I couldn't look it up. But
this was one of her friends.
One
right?
of her friends, yeah. So I'm assuming he was young.
Jeez.
Okay. Yeah.
Wow.
What we don't know is whether that text meant that Brittany herself had returned to the other side of the bay.
Or just her phone.
Exactly.
Right.
It should be noted that in the early morning hours of May 31st, so, you know, again, because this last ping was early May 31st, yeah. 1:47 was the last ping.
Okay.
Donnie's cell phone pinged off of towers near Chessie's house. Now, Chessie had a cell phone tower like directly across the street from her, but she says that she never saw Donnie or anybody by her house. What she speculated was that Donnie had gone to Mendy and Dustin's house, which was located near hers.
Mm.
So it still could have potentially bounced off the same cell tower.
Sure.
And remember, Dustin was one of the three people that the cousin named.
Right.
It's not exactly clear where Donnie spent the night that night, you know, like where he ended up, if he ended up going back across Styx River, or like where he slept. But the next night, May 31st, It has been reported that Donnie returned to the property near Styx River and stayed there with his wife, Wendy, and either two or three of their children.
Okay. In this other person's house.
I think in this other person's house. But see, this part's a little fuzzy because it says that the next morning, Donnie dropped them all off with Jennifer Moore. But it was apparently Jennifer Moore's house that they were staying in. So I don't exactly know. What I do know is that the night of May 31st, he was back in the Styx River area, so across the bay from like where Chessy lived. And Wendy did see him the morning of June 1st.
Okay.
Okay. So meanwhile, now we're talking about June 1st, right? Brittany's family didn't realize she was missing yet. Because, like I said, she kind of bounced between houses, and so it wasn't unusual for her to just not come home or whatever.
Right.
Even though they hadn't heard from her since she had left Chessy's house on the evening of the 30th, it wasn't until that day, June 1st, when a shocking event made them realize that things might not be okay with Brittany after all. According to Donnie's wife, Wendy, on the morning of June 1st, Donnie began acting erratically and threatening to kill himself.
Okay.
Wendy called Eric Winberg, the investigator in charge of the sex crime investigation, and alerted him to this fact. Now, I don't know why she decided to call him, but apparently Donnie was supposed to meet with Detective Winberg that afternoon, so that could be why she called him. So Winberg got the sheriff's office to put out a BOLO for Donnie because of his threats of self-harm.
Right.
Wendy also told Winberg that she was actively looking for him as well. So she's like, hey, I'm going to go out. I'm going to try to find him. You know, you do things on your end as well. Makes sense. Totally fine. The BOLO initially said it was unknown if he possessed any weapons, but it was later updated to read, quote, wife advises he does not possess any guns, end quote. At 2:16 p.m., a 911 call came in. Wendy had located her husband on a back road. Now, I believe the road was either close to their house or to Jennifer Moore's house. But it wasn't on the main road. It was, like I said, off on a back road. So one of the questions that has been asked over the years was, how did she know he was there?
Yeah.
According to Wendy, when she got there, Donnie was slumped over in his SUV with a gunshot wound to his head. He was alive, but was gravely wounded.
Was this a 25 caliber gunshot wound?
Well, it's actually even weirder than that. According to the 911 call transcript, the caller said two different times that they weren't going to touch Donnie. So though he was still alive, neither his wife, Wendy, nor their friend, Jennifer Moore, who had gone with Wendy to search for Donnie, attempted to render aid.
Interesting.
According to the documentary, 911 wasn't even their first call. I believe they called Detective Winberg first.
Okay.
Deputy Lucas Jones was the first officer to arrive on the scene, and I'm just going to read an excerpt from his incident report. Quote, upon our arrival in the area, a female subject flagged us down and pointed us in the direction of the Suburban. Another female subject was seen standing in the driver's doorway of the Suburban. The driver's door to the Suburban was open, and a male subject was observed laying back in the driver's seat. Another vehicle was parked directly beside the Suburban. The other vehicle was facing the same direction, almost window to window. The other vehicle was only a couple feet away from the Suburban. The female standing by the Suburban was ordered away until the scene could be declared safe. The male subject had an obvious gunshot wound on the right side of his head behind his ear. The male subject was still moving as we were trying to locate a gun. A small handgun was located on the floor by the subject's feet between the seat and the center console. End quote. So a couple of things about this. We later learned that it was Wendy who had been standing in the driver's doorway of the Suburban. But instead of helping her dying husband, Because remember, she told 911 that she wasn't going to touch him.
Yeah.
She took his phone and began deleting. She deleted at least 4 text messages that have never been recovered.
What the hell?
The second takeaway, which you already picked up on, was that Donnie shot himself, but according to Wendy, he didn't have a gun. So how did he shoot himself?
Right.
Well, that small handgun that the deputy found was, in fact, Brittany's 25 caliber weapon. Now, the third thing I want to point out is something that has led not just to conspiracy theories, but an actual reinvestigation into Donnie's death, which was ruled a suicide. In his report, Deputy Jones said that Donnie had a gunshot wound, quote, on the right side of his head behind his ear, end quote. Now, to a lot of people, that made them believe that the gunshot wound was in the back of Donnie's head with the trajectory going forward.
In my mind, when you say that, and, you know, if we are to believe it was a suicide, gun in mouth, pulls the trigger, exit wound behind the ear.
Yeah, but I think that the size of it made it clear that it was an entry wound and not an exit wound.
Okay.
Because I think it was really small. And again, it was a 25 caliber.
Yeah.
But, you know, behind the ear in the back of the head is an odd place to...
To kill yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's not... Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't hold it there. You know, people put it to their temple.
Or they put it in their mouth, like you said. Right. I mean, those are the two most common ways that people commit suicide with a gun.
Right.
But that apparently was not what... It looked like Donnie Holland was alive, but he never regained consciousness. He was rushed to a hospital, but died on June 3rd, 2012. As I mentioned, his death was officially ruled a suicide by Baldwin County authorities. But this quick suicide ruling was part of the reason why a good amount of people began to believe that Donnie's death may have been something else entirely. During the process of transporting him to the hospital, Donnie's hands were bagged in order to preserve gunshot residue evidence. But the test was never completed. Similarly, his hands could have been examined for blood and brain matter, which a firearms expert who was interviewed for the documentary said you often find on the hands of people who die in this way because their hand is so close to their head that they'll get blood and brain matter on their hands.
Right.
Well, they didn't check.
Okay.
Now, we have so much more to talk about before we get into theories, but I will briefly mention one that I came across early on. It was basically that Brittany shot Donnie, then made it look like a suicide and ran. Now, this partly came up because of the weird way Donnie was shot. A lot of people were speculating that it was murder and not suicide. But when I went to uncover.com, they had Donnie's autopsy report. In it, the ME states, quote, entrance in the right temple, 1 to 3 inches from the top of the head and centered in line with the right external auditory meatus. And right external auditory meatus is your ear canal.
Right, but didn't the initial report say it was behind the ear?
Yes.
But then the autopsy is the autopsy, it's in front of the ear.
Yeah, the autopsy says in the right temple, centered in line with the right external auditory meatus, which to me is actually more of the top of your jaw.
Right.
That's actually not your temple. Like the auditory meatus is below your temple.
Right.
But it says, is an entrance gunshot wound consisting of a half-inch round defect with a circumferential 1/16 pink abrasion collar, end quote. Now, the pink abrasion collar, I'm guessing, does that mean like a contact wound?
Yeah, either that or bruising from the blast.
Yeah. But, I mean, that seems to indicate to me that the gun was had contact.
Yeah.
With his skin, right?
Yeah.
Which is more consistent with suicide.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I mean, because again, if we're talking about likelihood, like if it's a murder, holding the gun to the head or away from the head, both happen. But I think with suicide, it's a lot more common to hold the gun to your head as opposed to away from your head.
Yeah, well, you don't want to miss.
Exactly. Exactly, right? It also says, quote, direction. The wound track travels from the decedent's right to left and upwards.
Okay.
Bullet fragments were also removed from the left parietal lobe, which is the upper middle left portion of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that sounds like Donnie wasn't shot in the back of the head at all.
No.
He may have had the gun kind of more toward the back of his head. Maybe.
Maybe.
But it doesn't.
That doesn't seem consistent with what the sheriff's report was.
Yeah, I know. But the autopsy report makes it sound as though he basically put it to his right temple and pulled the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
However, the way the gunshot is described by Chessie is more in line with the way the responding officer described it in his incident report, which is that the bullet wound was behind the ear. And she also said in the documentary that they pulled a bullet fragment out of his left jaw.
Hmm.
That's not what's in the autopsy.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's just another just weird inconsistency.
Because now you're suggesting if a bullet fragment was pulled from the left jaw, now the angle of the gun is changing.
Right. And so pulling a bullet fragment from the left jaw makes sense with the murder back of the head theory, right? Because you can see how if you've got a gun behind the ear, toward the back of the head, depending mm-hmm. on how you're angling it,
right.
you could see how that could go down
right.
and get lodged in the left jaw.
Right.
But that's not what the autopsy report says. The autopsy says it went right to left and up.
Right.
Which is the exact opposite.
Right. So which is it?
I mean, I'm more inclined to believe the autopsy report than, you know, the sheriff's deputy who just kind of arrived on the scene and saw it. I mean, I guess. And in terms of this specific discrepancy from Chessie, that I can put down to like just misinformation, you know, like
sure.
she was told one thing because which would make sense given what the officer wrote in the report.
Mm-hmm.
And so that she just got that from there. So like, I don't think that this inconsistency from Chessie is like necessarily suspicious. It's just it's all very confusing. And in a lot of the news articles that you read about this, it says that he was shot behind the ear.
Which is not consistent with the suicide.
Yeah.
Right.
Which, of course, people picked up on over the years and are like, wait a second, what's actually going on here? But again, the autopsy report, to me, and I'm not an expert at all, but to me, that's not what that says.
Right.
So did Donnie shoot himself? Did somebody else shoot him? Yet another question. Because the thing is that even if we go with the autopsy report, kind of what we're picturing from that, somebody still could have shot him.
Yeah, you absolutely. Know?
That doesn't necessarily mean it was a suicide.
Right. Somebody could have been in the back seat.
Yeah.
And held the gun up to his head.
Or even in the passenger seat.
Or in the passenger seat.
Because it was yeah. the right side of his head.
Right.
Which was the passenger side.
Yeah.
Now, we will talk more about Donnie's death later, but for right now, it's important because it's how Brittany's family realized she was missing. On June 1st, when all this was happening, they frantically tried to contact her to tell her about her uncle, but she was nowhere to be found. And again, at this point, I don't think anybody knew that she had been with him on the night of the 30th.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was more they were just trying to contact her because her uncle was in the hospital and was dying.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, on June 2nd, 3 days after she was last seen, Brittany's family filed a missing persons report with Mobile Police. Now, Mobile, again, is where Chessie lives. That's where she was last seen, even though where she actually likely disappeared was Baldwin County across the bay.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't know that at the time.
Right.
Searches were quickly organized, though from what Chessie says, and I believe this just having covered so many of these cases, she said that the police like really weren't super helpful at the beginning, which is kind of surprising given that they already had this investigation going on. But she said that they were really organizing a lot of the searches themselves. But more than 70 volunteers and search and rescue teams combed a 5-mile radius near the Styx River campsite where Brittany's phone had pinged. So again, these are a little bit later. Police did help them get the cell phone records. I'm not saying they weren't doing anything.
Right.
But I think in terms of boots on the ground, Chessie feels that they really had to do a lot of the heavy lifting there. Missing persons flyers with Brittany's photo blanketed the Mobile and Baldwin County areas. Class Kids, which is a missing persons foundation, also got involved and helped do searches. So there were a lot of searches being done for Brittany. But despite extensive efforts, no trace of her was found in those initial searches. This episode of And Then They Were Gone is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible financial geniuses, monetary magicians, these are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your personalized closet. Then they show up to your door in as little as 2 days. And let me tell you, I'm on the other side of the country and they still got here super quick. Then when you're ready for new clothes, you just swap them out. I'm an elder millennial, and so jeans are kind of like the thing that I can't figure out right now. And so in my new bag that I just got, I ordered 2 different pairs of jeans because I'm still trying to figure out what actually works for me. And I love it because I can rent high quality designer clothes without having to make that financial investment. Plus, there's no laundry required and no time wasted shopping. So right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 60% off of their first month. That's up to $150 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, A-R-M-O-I-R-E. .style/ATTWG to get up to 60% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. If you've been listening to this show for a while, then you know that I'm a podcaster and a realtor. And on some days, like today, I have to do both. I spent all day in a courthouse watching a trial that we're covering, and then I had to drive an hour and a half away to put a lockbox on a new listing. It was a long day, to say the least, and normally I would have been exhausted at about 3 when I still had several hours to go. But I've recently been adding Everyday Dose into my morning routine, specifically into my morning coffee, and let me tell you, I was driving home late tonight and I felt great. Everyday Dose is coffee plus benefits. They combine high-quality coffee with powerful ingredients like lion's mane and chaga, collagen protein, and nootropics to fuel your brain, boost focus, and give you clean, sustained energy all day long. It tastes just like coffee without the downside. No crash, no jitters, just clean, sustained energy. Right now for Black Friday, get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/ATTWG or use code ATTWG at checkout. In the immediate aftermath of Brittany's disappearance, law enforcement and Brittany's loved ones faced 2 mysteries. What happened to Brittany? And did it have anything to do with the disturbing allegations swirling around her family? Looking at the immediate news coverage of Brittany's disappearance is another reason I don't trust Chessie. In a transcript of an HLN show hosted by reporter Jane Velez Mitchell, Chessie is asked about her daughter's disappearance. This interview took place on June 11th, 2012, 9 days after her daughter went missing. In one part, her father, Wallace, says, quote, her uncle has committed suicide, and supposedly he was the last one she was with, and so we're worried about that, end quote. Then Chessie says, quote, I'm hoping to God, and I really don't think he'd hurt my baby, end quote. So 9 days after Brittany went missing, after they've gotten her cell phone records and found out that Donnie's the one who picked her up and she had never had plans to go see Courtney, she stated publicly on national television that she didn't believe that Donnie would hurt her baby. Wallace seemed a little less sure.
Chessie would later would say that she didn't know anything about this, about the allegations.
Until after Brittany went missing. Yeah. So none of that, I'm about to get to that. Later in the interview, Jane Velez Mitchell asks Chessie a question. Quote, all right, Chessie, did he have any, did Donald Holland have any reason to commit suicide right after your daughter disappears? End quote. This is what Chessie says. Again, June 11th. They have the phone records. They know what was going on, right? Quote, well, we really don't know that. That's what we're trying to figure out. I mean, I'm pretty sure he has financial problems. I believe we all do at this time. End quote.
Financial problems?
Financial problems.
What the hell would that have to do with?
She's saying he could have killed himself because he has financial problems. Not a single fucking word about the investigation.
Mm.
Which she has to have known about by then.
Right.
I said it was 9 days after she went missing. It was actually 9 days after she was reported missing. So it's been nearly 2 weeks since Brittany was last seen. And we're still supposed to believe that this hasn't come out?
Mm-hmm.
Like, give me a break.
Right.
Now, I will say she might not have known that Brittany had already been talking to police. I don't know if Winberg would have said that to her or whatever by this point.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, there's no fucking chance that Eric Winberg or some other detective or any member of her family
wouldn't have brought this up.
Yeah.
Right.
In 2 weeks.
Right.
And that says nothing of the fact that I think she had known for at least 2 months.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But, like, financial problems? Chessie went on national television and protected Donnie instead of giving the information that she had, which is information that could have been extremely relevant to her daughter's disappearance. Because again, by this point, I think she was probably already not happy with the amount of effort the police were putting into the searches.
Mm-hmm.
Because one thing I will say for Chessie is that she worked her ass off on these searches. She did so many. She was tromping through the woods, I mean, for a long period of time. She was really, really working hard to find Brittany. And that's one of the reasons why I don't think she has anything to do with her disappearance. But for her to go on national television and ignore what is a very clear motive,
right,
really did her daughter a disservice. She could have gotten so much more attention on her daughter's story because it's a good story, right?
Yeah.
You know, as sad and like sickening as it is, it's a hook. Yes, this sounds cynical, and it is, but it's also true. A lot of times when you have a family member or a loved one who goes missing, like you need a hook in order to get the press to pay attention and in order to get the police to pay attention in a lot of cases.
Right.
But she didn't do that. She protected Donnie instead and said he had financial problems. It's one of the other things that I don't understand really why. Like, why does she choose to protect him? And why did her story about Brittany's state of mind change?
I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
Now, I will say that initially, police publicly maintained that Brittany's disappearance was unrelated to the investigation into her family.
Wait, what?
Yeah, they did say that initially. Once the arrests started happening and the media realized that these people being arrested were related to this girl who went missing, police are like, yeah, but it's two separate things.
Are they stupid?
I don't know if they were trying to protect.
I mean, yes.
You know what
arrest,
I mean? Like,
the arrest. Okay. Yes. The arrests are a result of the investigation for alleged sex abuse. But you can't sit there and say those are two different things.
Right.
Like, she went missing after she was with one of the alleged abusers.
Yeah.
They're directly related.
I don't see a world in which they're not.
And she was talking to the police.
Yeah. I don't know. But that's what they publicly stated. Then on June 19th, 2012, so like a week after that TV interview that we were talking about, and about 2.5 weeks after Brittany vanished, Baldwin County deputies arrested two of Brittany's relatives. Her uncle, Scott Wood, the one who was the whistleblower of this whole thing, and her uncle by marriage, Dustin Kent, who was Mendy's husband. Scott was charged with second-degree sodomy, sexual abuse, and incest. Dustin was charged with sodomy and second-degree rape. These charges involved minor victims within the family. Dustin and Scott were also the two men who were implicated in the Facebook message from the cousin, along with Donnie.
Right.
But the arrests didn't stop there. Over that summer of 2012, more family members were implicated. Derek Wood, 21, Brittany's older brother, whom Chessie had called Brittany's protector, was arrested on July 13th. He was charged with second-degree rape, incest, and sexual abuse. Investigators alleged that Derek had participated in the sexual assault of an underage relative. Donnie Holland Jr., 20, Brittany's cousin and the son of Donnie and Wendy, was arrested a few days later in July 2012. He was charged with second-degree rape, secondary sexual abuse, and incest. His alleged victim was the same 12-year-old girl who Derek was accused of abusing. William Billy Brownlee, 50, a close family friend of the Hollands, was also arrested in July 2012, charged with sex abuse and sodomy for abusing minors. Brownlee was allegedly involved in assaults alongside the family members. Wendy Wood Holland, 35, Brittany's Aunt Wendy, Donnie Holland's widow and Chessie's sister, was arrested in August 2012. Initially, she was charged with child endangerment, and her two young children were removed from her home by social services. By November 2012, as evidence mounted, Wendy faced additional charges: first-degree sodomy, sexual torture, and sex abuse of a child. Mendy Wood Kent, Wendy's twin sister, another of Brittany's aunts, married to Dustin Kent, would later be charged as well, though that came a bit later in the investigation. Additional family friends arrested included Nelton Butch Morgan, James Kumba, and Jennifer Moore, the woman who found Donnie with Wendy on June 1st. In total, 11 individuals were indicted in connection with this incestuous child sex abuse ring. As these arrests unfolded, prosecutors described it as the largest sex abuse ring ever uncovered in Alabama. According to court documents, this group of relatives and friends had systematically sexually abused children, including their own kids, nieces and nephews, and even shared the children amongst themselves. The abuse had been going on for years. Not only was the late Donnie Holland implicated in this, but investigators said that he was the ringleader. But Chessie apparently had no idea that any of this was happening.
Bullshit. Brittany's own brother was involved in this?
Yeah.
So Chessie's entire family, essentially, was doing this. And you mean to tell me she didn't know?
After her daughter had already been raped by a family member as a child, she apparently didn't see any other potential danger that her daughter could have been in. It wasn't until the end of July 2012 when Chessie began to publicly state that she believed Brittany had been sexually abused by her brother-in-law, Donnie. She told reporters that authorities told her that Brittany had been one of his victims, but that she didn't know before that. This is from an interview that Chessie did with Fox 10. Quote, Chessie Wood says she asked her daughter Brittany if anyone had touched her or made her feel uncomfortable, and she told her no, end quote. Chessie went on to say, quote, a lot of rape victims do this. We don't know why they will protect the molester, end quote. But when did she have this conversation?
Okay, yes, thank you. I was just going to say that.
Like, yeah.
Are you kidding me? Now she's going back and saying that she had that conversation, but...
But she didn't find out about any of this until after Brittany disappeared?
why the inconsistencies.
Exactly.
Because she's covering for shit too. I wouldn't be surprised if she was involved in it.
Well, trust me, when these arrests started happening, that was what social media was saying too, you know? And again, it's just, I truly, and of course, this is my opinion, I don't know anything. I truly don't believe she was involved in Britney's disappearance at all. But she is obviously covering up a lot of shit.
Yeah.
Even in 2025, 13 years after Britney went missing, Chessie was still saying that she had no idea what was going on in her family, telling In Touch Investigates, quote, "I used to be one of those moms. I used to believe anything that happened to them, they would come tell me because we had such an open relationship. I put trust in family where I shouldn't have, but I was raised that family is your family and they're the number one people you can trust," end quote.
Her daughter had already been sexually abused by a relative.
Yeah. Like, she was saying this in 2025. And listen, I am not coming on here saying that all parents whose children are the victims of sexual abuse should have known what was going on.
No, not at all. But this large, with Chessie's entire family, including her own son, involved in it. Come on.
Knowing all of that and coming over a decade after all these arrests, she's still saying, "I put trust in family." Like, open your eyes. Like, what are you saying? But let's leave that there and hop back real quick. Because remember how I said there were 11 people arrested?
Yeah.
Well, if you were counting, I only named 10. That's because the final arrest didn't come until the next year, in 2013. And that arrest was probably the most controversial of them all. And that's where we're going to pick up in the next episode.
God, cliffhanger, come on.
Yeah, this is a lot.
Yeah.
And there's so much to get through and so many names, and there's more, so much more. So next week, we're going to talk about that final arrest. We're going to talk about what happened to all these people who got arrested. We're going to delve further into the investigation into what happened to Britney. And we're going to talk about if everything is as it appears. So we've got a lot more coming, and we'll be back with part two next week. Brittany Wood has been missing from Mobile, Alabama since May 30th, 2012. She is a white female with blonde to brown hair and blue eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was approximately 5'3" and 105 pounds. She has a tattoo of the name Peyton surrounded by butterflies on her left leg. Her lip is pierced. She was last seen wearing a blue t-shirt, blue denim shorts, and flip-flops. She was carrying a pink or teal tote bag containing extra clothing, a red curling iron, a makeup bag, and a cell phone. Brittany was 19 when she went missing. She would be 33 today. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Brittany Wood, please contact the Mobile Police Department at 251-208-1700 or submit an anonymous tip. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode. Or if you're on Patreon, you can access part two right now.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Assisted customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.